This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Stephen Budiansky, speaking with us today about America's victory at sea during the war with Britain in the years 1812-1815. Your new book, Stephen, comes with the title Perilous Fight, and you tell an heroic story. But in your prologue, you also say that for the last 200 years in both Britain and America, it is a story that for the most part has been forgotten. Why?
Well, I think it's a complex series of reasons why this war has been so neglected. Partly, it's because it was the strangest war in American history. It was a war we almost seemed to cold-bloodedly move into as a matter of rational policy rather than the heat of the moment. It was a war whose peace treaty that ended it was a complete return to the status quo ante. It didn't even address the great issues that had brought America to war, namely Britain's seizing of our merchant ships and our sailors and forcing them into service in the Royal Navy. It was a war that deeply divided America. It was the closest vote for a declaration of war to this day in the history of our country. And then, you know, when the first real professional historians came along at the end of the 19th century, people like Henry Adams, they were determined to show that they could find the real historical forces, the real reasons behind all of the political rhetoric. So they tended to dismiss any attempt to put a heroic interpretation on the war. They pretty much were scornful of the idea that it was a second war of American independence. They dismissed Madison as a weak and hesitant president who almost got us into this war through mistake and his indecisiveness. They tended to say, well, this was really not a glorious war at all. It was an inglorious war because we were lusting for the lands of Britain and Canada and Spain and Florida, or we really wanted to wipe out the American Indians, or it was all party politics. But actually, I think the war stock has been rising a bit lately. And I saw the historian Gordon Wood recently wrote that Americans at the time instinctively understood the momentous things that Madison had accomplished, even if historians have tended to be baffled by it ever since.
Describe the opponents at the beginning of the war. It's almost as if it's a David and Goliath. America is weak and backward. The British have the greatest power in the world, and yet we declare war on Britain.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was extraordinary. It was like, you know, the joke about the tiny country, about, you know, the lion who roared. I mean, Britain's navy was literally 50 to 100 times the size of America's navy. America's navy almost didn't exist. Britain had this string of unbroken victories at sea. They, in their wars with France for the last, decade and a half, they had achieved something like 400 victories in ship-to-ship actions and had lost maybe 10 of their own ships in that whole time. There was this extraordinary sense of moral superiority, I would say, on the part of the British as well, particularly about their naval prowess. And here was America, who had put up with almost a decade of real insults to its sovereignty of a kind that no nation really can put up with and keep its independence. The British, with impunity, were seizing American merchant vessels that were attempting to trade with France and the continent. They were seizing American sailors, forcing them into service in the Royal Navy. Some probably at least 4,000, maybe as many as 10,000 American seafarers taken off. Sometimes the British ships were actually sitting right outside the three-mile limit of New York Harbor and stopping every single American merchant ship that would sail in or out of the harbor, demanding to see their papers, seeing if there was any evidence they were trading with France, and then taking them off as prizes to Halifax if there was even a hint they were. It was an extraordinary act of chutzpah on the part of America to declare war, and I think the British expected it would be a very easy matter for them to deal with.
There are two wars. There's the American land war
Across
the Canadian frontier, and that's the war the Americans are very smug about. They think they're going to win that one in a matter of months. And then there's the naval war, the war at sea. Your book is about the war at sea. So sum up the war on land. That was an American failure practically from beginning to end.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jefferson was one of many who smugly and confidently predicted that it would be a romp for America. He said, the conquest of all of Canada would be a simple matter of mere marching, he said. We would just march in there and take it. And the Federalists who opposed the war at home, there were some wonderful newspapers that I looked through in doing my research for the book, and one Federalist paper had this headline that said, disaster on disaster on land. And another one actually had this wonderful cartoon they were planning to run before their offices were ransacked by a Jeffersonian Republican mob in Baltimore, showing a federal officer engaged in his rapid descent upon Canada mounted on a terrapin. And, I mean, it was a disaster on land. And by the end of 1813 and certainly the summer of 1814, it was absolutely a deadlock on land. It was clear that that was not where we were going to pressure Britain.
So how do we pressure them at sea? I mean, how many ships do we have, let's say, in 1812 as opposed to the British? And, how do we propose to win that war?
Yeah, well, we had maybe 20, if you're counting them generously, to Britain's 700. Britain had over 100 ships on the American station alone. And in the first few months of the war, there are these three stunning victories in single ship actions, American frigates versus British frigates, that absolutely sent American confidence soaring, that tended to damp down the political opposition at home, and that just sent shockwaves through British public opinion. Again, here was this invincible Navy, the pride of the nation. There was also, I think you have to look behind it, I mean, there was this very powerful attitude, which I describe in my book, among the British public and certainly among the British ruling class, that a democracy like America simply could never become a great power like Britain was. Only an aristocratic nation like Britain that had these august institutions and stability and this sense of aristocratic honor could achieve greatness. And America was really doomed to wallowing in its vulgar roots and never achieving greatness. There were these three encounters between single American ships and single British ships. And two of the ships were essentially destroyed in the actions. One was captured and brought back as a prize to New York.
But the famous one is the Constitution and the Guerrière.
That was the very first American victory, right within a little over a month after the start of the war. And, of course, you know, the news took some time to get to Britain, and the accumulating effect of the news of these three victories really stunned the British.
Where was the Guerrière Constitution engagement?
Well, that was in the Atlantic. It was off Boston.
But it was very bloody. I mean, the American ship sinks the British ship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was left a wreck, and it was done in about 30 minutes, which also simply stunned the British.
The other thing that stuns the British is that our ships are better built, heavier, more weatherly.
This was actually a funny twist in the way the British tried to play it, because when you read the comments in the London Times and in the British Naval Chronicle, which was sort of the semi-official organ of the Royal Navy, and in Parliament, there's this sense of outrage on the part of the British. It's almost like we were cheating that we had frigates that were larger and carried more guns than theirs. And this actually became this common excuse on the part of the British to excuse why they were beaten. They said, well, it's really not fair to call these things frigates. These are like our much more powerful ships of the line. It was really, sort of a cheat for the Americans to claim any sense of an honorable victory in such a ship-on-ship engagement. And it was clearly sour grapes. It was clearly trying to find an excuse. And, you know, as Theodore Roosevelt wrote in his history of the Naval War of 1812, he said, you know, I think it should be a matter of pride that we were able to build better ships than the British.
During most of the war, the British manage a blockade on American East Coast. They can land troops at will, which they do in 1814, and burn the White House.
Yeah.
What is our naval strategy? How does that work?
Yeah. One of the real heroes in my book, as far as I'm concerned, is William Jones, who became the Secretary of the Navy at the beginning of 1813. And he, from the start, basically looked at it in a very clear-eyed way. He had been a merchant captain, ship owner himself. He had fought in the Revolution as a 15-year-old at the Battle of Trenton. He was a very knowledgeable man and in some ways a strikingly modern man. And he basically said, these single ship actions that we've won are great. They keep alive American national feeling, but it's not a sustainable strategy for our tiny outnumbered navy. And he said, we have to concentrate on hitting Britain essentially where it hurts in their seagoing commerce. And he's constantly sending orders to his captain saying, basically, avoid the glorious ship-on-ship duels with your counterparts in the Royal Navy. Go after their merchant ships and burn them. And by the summer of 1814, despite the tightening British blockade, the United States manages to send a couple of small warships, a number of privateers, right into the mouth of the English Channel, and they are seizing, capturing, burning, sinking British merchant ships, and really sending shivers into the hearts of the British merchants who are appealing to the Admiralty and to Parliament for protection, demanding to know how on earth could the vaunted Royal Navy allow these ships even to have gotten out of the American ports in the face of this supposed blockade. And I think this has been an underappreciated factor in what really started making the British say, we've got to bring this to an end however we can and quickly.
The war was also the establishment of the United States Navy. Talk about the attitudes toward a navy prior to the war and after the war.
When Jefferson was president, he actually proposed mothballing the entire U.S. Navy. He had this typical Jeffersonian scheme. He was going to build this giant covered sort of dry dock by the Washington Navy Yard and put the whole fleet there. And there was this idea, very much part and parcel of Jeffersonian republicanism, thinking that a standing navy, just like a standing army, is a threat to liberty. It will lead to adventurism on the part of the nation. It will lead to high taxes. And so we're probably better off without a navy at all.
And Madison had shared those views before he became president.
Yeah. I mean, Madison was very much of the view that war was bad, not that he was a pacifist, but because war leads to armies and navies lead to taxes, and taxes lead to oppression and tyranny.
And Madison changes his attitude soon after he becomes president.
By the time the wars end, it's very hard to find any trace of this attitude. Before the war, I mean, in January of 1812, Madison's party in Congress votes overwhelmingly against even a modest expansion of the Navy. 6 months later, they're all voting to declare war. By the end of the war, there's no question the Navy is here to stay. The Navy is put on a plan of considerable funding, gradual increase, and it's really the beginning of America's emergence as a world power.
One of the Adamses, I think Charles, says that the very moment that the Constitution defeated the Guerriere, that's when America becomes a world power.
Yeah, with a bit of hyperbole, but I think a lot of poetic justice. He wrote this wonderful little paper for a Massachusetts Historical Society meeting, and he said, this was the moment America emerges as a world power, this exact time when the Guerriere struck her flag to the Constitution.
And the war also produces a kind of union of feeling within the United States. I mean, there's a lot of factionalism prior to the war. People identify themselves with their regions, but after the war, you get an idea of the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And Albert Gallatin, who was the Treasury Secretary and really opposed to the war because it would cost so much, quite a skeptic throughout the war, afterwards really, I think, summed it up. He said that the people feel more American than that they act and think more as a nation.
I mean, Washington, having been burned down, gave them an idea of a nation to defend, honor, and protect.
But, you know, I think it was much more the naval victories which really galvanized the American spirit during the war. And you see this even in Federalist New England, which had bitterly opposed the war. They couldn't help celebrating these naval victories, feeling that, you know, these are some of their own. And when you contrast that with these disasters on land and this utter incompetence of many of the American generals, this overblown confidence being shot, you have these naval victories and this sense of we stood up to the mightiest sea power on earth.
Stephen, name some of the heroic naval figures that appeared.
Isaac Hull is certainly one who stands out above all, the captain of the Constitution in that first American victory against the Guerriere. Stephen Decatur, William Bainbridge was one of the other frigate captains who achieved one of these victories. A very complex man, in some ways a very dark man, but who fights what is tactically the most brilliant engagement of the war.
One other point, 15% of the American seamen were African-American.
Yeah. It was both the merchant service and the U.S. Navy at that time was a rare opportunity for free African-Americans to achieve opportunity and even equality of pay. Blacks and whites messed together on naval ships. They served together. There weren't any black officers, but there were many very experienced African-American sailors on merchant ships who ranked higher and actually were paid more than white sailors. All of that changes, actually, after the war. Segregation comes in, and it would be over 100 years until the end of World War II when that wrong would be righted.
Thank you, Stephen Budiansky, for speaking with us today about America's naval war with Britain in the years 1812-1815. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.